Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In the 10 years since planes crashed into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in rural Pennsylvania, what have we learned about the men who planned and carried out the attacks, and about what U.S. officials could have done to protect American lives? Although Osama bin Laden was killed in last spring's U.S. raid on his compound in Pakistan, no one is naive enough to believe the threat of terrorism or even al-Qaeda specifically died along with its most notorious leader. But my guest today, as my guest today demonstrated with his reporting over the last decade, there is much to be gained from understanding how the attacks were planned and carried out, and even from examining just how close some U.S. enforcement professionals came to preventing the destruction altogether. Lawrence Wright is an author, screenwriter, playwright, and staff writer for The New Yorker, although he grew up in Dallas and today makes his home in Austin. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 2007. It's been re-released now in a 10th anniversary trade paperback edition. Larry, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be back on the air in Dallas.
So the book was first published 5 years after the attacks. Now we've had another 5 years passed since then. To what extent did the bin Laden raid bring al-Qaeda closer to its extinction?
Well, it made a huge difference, I think. I don't think you can say that al-Qaeda would ever end if bin Laden were still alive. But that doesn't mean that it has ended now that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed considerably in the years since 9/11. It has a number of affiliates around the world and new leaders arising, especially, in my opinion, Anwar al-Awlaki, the Yemeni-American leader who is hiding out in Yemen, who looks to me to be the real successor to Osama bin Laden, not really Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's nominally in charge right now.
Can you talk about what we know about the cultivation of sort of second-tier leadership during the years that bin Laden was still alive?
It's been a difficult challenge for them because they were always operational leaders were always the ones that were getting killed by drones or captured. So, you know, that position has been very vulnerable. But honestly, And the al-Qaeda cadre, the Sharia Council that surrounded bin Laden, is still pretty much intact. And they're largely Egyptians, headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri. There are several Libyans now attached to it. But essentially, it's been able to avoid extinction despite all of our great efforts. You know, the fact that we got bin Laden is an extraordinary thing. But there are other people that are still involved in the leadership of al-Qaeda that are still out there and still directing traffic. And I think we won't be able to say that al-Qaeda is finished until they've been rounded up.
Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about internal conflict within the organization and how that is resolved?
Well, it was interesting. Immediately after bin Laden was killed, Ayman al-Zawahiri has been the number two guy since the beginning. But he was not immediately named the new leader. Saif al-Adel, who is sort of their military guy, but who has been in, I don't know exactly how you'd call it, safekeeping in Iran, I suppose, he was named a temporary head of al-Qaeda. So there must have been some level of dissension within the movement, and I'm supposing that Zawahiri finally prevailed, but it was very striking to me that he didn't immediately ascend to that level.
So let's talk about this. I mean, it's certainly arguable that for the 9.5 years between 9/11 and his death, Osama bin Laden could have felt victorious simply in evading capture.
Yeah.
Is it possible to speculate whether he imagined he would last anywhere near that long?
Well, not really. I think that he always expected that he would die. You know, he hoped to die in battle. He had two bodyguards normally, and he gave them guns with two bullets in them that they were supposed to use on him if it appeared that he might be captured. The last thing he wanted was to be captured. He wanted to become a martyr. and that's what he's become in the eyes of his followers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to what extent does that influence people who were not involved with the movement before to suddenly look kindly upon al-Qaeda?
You know, I think that we are seeing a burst of, sort of commemorative retribution on the part of al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda followers right now. But, the truth is that the loss of bin Laden is a catastrophic blow to that movement. There's not a real charismatic leader that can take his place. Al-Awlaki, as I said, comes as close as anyone, and he's a very dangerous man. But to lose bin Laden, especially in such a dramatic fashion, I think that has been a crippling blow to the organization.
What's fascinating is that if we go back to his early life, Osama bin Laden seems anything but an obvious candidate for the malevolent role he ultimately took on within al-Qaeda. Can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, his childhood?
Yeah, he grew up in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah. His father, Mohammed bin Laden, was one of the most famous men in the country. He was, in many respects, the man who built modern-day Saudi Arabia. The bin Laden company, the construction company that he headed, built many of the roads, the universities, the hospitals, the hotels. It's very difficult to be anywhere in Saudi Arabia and not see the hand of Mohammed bin Laden on that. It was the largest private company in the country. And they also rebuilt the mosque in Mecca, which is perhaps their proudest accomplishment. But every Muslim who goes on the Hajj enters this vast temple that was created by Osama bin Laden's father. Osama didn't really know his father very well. He had 55 brothers and sisters by various mothers. And his father died in a plane crash when he was 9 years old. So the connection to his father was not very intense, but the legend of his father was extremely powerful, and he grew up in the shadow of this immense, towering figure, and I think that certainly influenced his feelings about what he needed to accomplish in life. When 9/11 happened and we, first heard about bin Laden, there was a lot of talk about how he had this sort of dissolute youth and spent a lot of time kicking up his heels in Beirut and so on. None of that was true. He was always very Spartan, extremely religious. He became more religious in high school, but he was essentially a very pious young man.
How orthodox was his understanding of the faith as a young man? Understanding of the Muslim faith. Was he sort of less extreme, even in although he was quite devout as a young man? I mean, I want to get to how his beliefs sort of changed over time.
Well, there was a big change in Saudi Arabia and in much of the Arab world during the early years of Osama. He grew up in the Wahhabi version of Islam, which is, an extreme Salafist viewpoint, which means fundamentalist, essentially. But by itself, the Wahhabis were not political, and it was the influx of a lot of Muslim brothers, mainly from Egypt, who were fleeing persecution in Egypt, and they came in to Saudi Arabia. The Muslim brothers were very politically oriented. And that combination of the Wahhabi strand in Saudi Arabia, the extreme fundamentalism, plus the political orientation of the Muslim brothers coming out of Syria, but also especially Egypt, that created the particular fervent, activist, fundamentalist brand of Islam that we see so manifested in Osama bin Laden.
So I want to talk now about Ayman al-Zawahiri, who, as you mentioned, is the nominal, if temporary, head of al-Qaeda since the time that bin Laden has been killed. He, in turn, was deeply influenced by Saeed Qutb, whose vehement hatred of the U.S. began when he came here to study education in the 1940s. What did Qutb find so distasteful?
Everything. He arrived in America with a real chip on his shoulder. He'd been kind of run out of Egypt for a while because the king was angry at him. He was essentially a bureaucrat, but he had a poison pen, and he was very critical of the king's regime. So some friends arranged for him to come to America in 1948. And from the moment he landed in New York and until he left, he traveled all across America. Everything he saw, he found fault with. He didn't like, for instance, the way that his hair was cut. He didn't like the attitude of American women, which seemed very forceful, and they were way too sexually charged for his taste. I have to say, he was a man of color. He came to America at a time when America had not reconciled itself to racial divisions inside his country, and so he felt the sting of prejudice. One of his classmates in Greeley, Colorado, where he was teaching, told me about going to a movie theater. Qutb was a great fan of American movies. That's one weakness he had. And the theater owner told them, "I can't let you in because you're Negroes." And one of the classmates said, "We're not Negroes, we're Egyptians." And the theater owner said, "Oh, in that case, come on in." And Qutb refused to do so. He said, "If you will not let a black American into this place, then this black Egyptian refuses to enter." So he had a high moral stance, and in some cases he was very acute, maybe better than his contemporary Americans at looking at the flaws of American culture. But he found nothing to admire, and he returned to Egypt and wrote a series of very influential articles in Al Rasala, an Egyptian literary magazine, about America. And at that time, most Egyptians idolized America. It was, the most powerful country in the world, and it had no history of colonialism. And so it was quite a shock for many people to see the views that Qutb expressed.
And Zawahiri was incensed when Qutb was condemned to death, essentially, by the Egyptian government for conspiracy.
Oh, it's really intriguing. Zawahiri's uncle had begun as a student of Saeed Qutb when he was a young man studying Arabic grammar. Zawahiri's uncle was taught by Saeed Qutb, and then he grew up to become his lawyer. And he was the last man to see Saeed Qutb alive in prison. He went to visit Qutb, and Qutb gave him his Quran, and then he was hanged. This was 1965, and Ayman al-Zawahiri was 15 years old, and he started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government. Imagine a 15-year-old child taking on that, and he dedicated the rest of his life to doing that.
Lawrence Wright is my guest. He's an author, screenwriter, playwright, and staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also a native Texan. His book is called The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright. We're talking about his book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Larry, we'll go back to the details of these relationships and the evolution of Al-Qaeda in a minute, but I want to talk about this. Throughout the book, there is this thread of the extreme influence of this sense of humiliation in cultivating Islamic extremism. What forms has that humiliation or perceived humiliation taken over the past few decades?
Well, there are two main kinds, I guess, of humiliation that we could talk about. One is actual, real, physical humiliation that many Muslim men have experienced, including Ayman al-Zawahiri, in prison, especially the Egyptian prisons. They were torture chambers. Zawahiri was tortured. He was in prison for 3 years following the assassination of Anwar al-Sadat, which he was tangentially involved in. And he talks about being beaten with electrical cables and tortured with dogs. An FBI agent who spent a lot of time in Cairo talking to the Egyptian police talked about how they would use dogs to wild starving dogs put into a cage with handcuffed prisoners, and sometimes actually we would have sexual relations with the prisoner, with the dogs. This unbelievable sense of humiliation that these men have endured. And so Zawahiri was a surgeon, a doctor, came from a very distinguished family on both sides of his family. His great uncle was the head of Al-Asr, and his grandfather was the founder of the Arab League. I mean, he was an extremely distinctive family, and he was put into those conditions. And he came out, and he was, he had been a doctor, but he came out, he was a butcher. And it's that kind of bloody attitude, the born of revenge, that is what I think accounts for the appetite for blood that you find in Al-Qaeda, which is so unusual in most terrorist movements. Now, there's another strand of the humiliation trend, I think, which is different. And it's the one, you hear Osama bin Laden talking about humiliation all the time, and yet he was not tortured in prison, and he had none of those kinds of experiences. And I think what he's referencing is the sense of loss that's common to many Muslims, the sense that theirs was once the predominant civilization in the world, and for centuries it's been in retreat. And there's a sense of loss and what I could call humiliation, that they've been displaced by these other heretical powers. And that is the sense of humiliation that bin Laden is summoning up when he's talking in his speeches.
Talk about how the relationship formed between Zawahiri and bin Laden when, I guess, Zawahiri was bin Laden's personal physician.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now that bin Laden is dead, it's pretty clear that everybody knows now that he did not have kidney disease. He was not on dialysis, as the CIA thought. There were a lot of suggestions, that turned out to be wrong about bin Laden.
Height. Excuse me for interrupting, but he was not 6'6".
No, he was not. It's still unclear exactly how tall he was. There was a 6-foot Navy SEAL who lay down next to the corpse of bin Laden, and they said that bin Laden was somewhat larger, but they didn't specify. And as I understand, the president met with the members of the Navy SEAL team, he gave one of them a tape measure because they had failed to take that little item along with them. But people I spoke to said that bin Laden was 6 feet or a little bit above that. Not a giant the way that the CIA thought he was. But this notion that he was ill, I think he was ill. He had a chronic low blood pressure. He, during battles on several occasions, he would faint. Zawahiri would give him infusions of saline solution and other kinds of vitamins that would keep him cogent and keep him from passing out when he was under stress. So he did have physical illnesses and ailments. And now I suppose we won't really know what they are, but that was part of the dependency that he had on Ayman al-Zawahiri. The greater dependency, I think, was that Zawahiri had a terrorist organization already in place. His group, called al-Jihad, that he formed in Egypt to overthrow the Egyptian government, was in exile in Peshawar in Pakistan. And when he and Osama bin Laden met in the mid-80s there, he was able to surround this charismatic, young, wealthy Saudi with an organization that bin Laden was nominally now the head of, but which Zawahiri really ran.
Because from the beginning, Zawahiri did not have that kind of charisma that bin Laden possessed.
No. In fact, he ran his own organization into the ground on several occasions. He's not the kind of person that people, are motivated to jump out of their chair and follow. He's quarrelsome. He's dogmatic. He's often careless. So he's made a lot of mistakes in his past, and he's repelled a lot of his former friends. So that's not to say that he's ineffective. I mean, he's been able to hold this organization together for decades now.
How did bin Laden shift his sights from fighting the Soviet incursion in Afghanistan to resisting U.S. presence in Africa and in Saudi Arabia?
It's an interesting twist, isn't it? Because we were nominal allies at that time,
mm-hmm.
although it's not true that the U.S. actually funded bin Laden and his group. But we had the same enemy.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend, essentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the moment there was talk about turning against America, even in Afghanistan, but it was only talk. But when bin Laden was in in Sudan from 92 to 96, it was at that time, you remember the great famine in Somalia,
mm-hmm.
and Americans and other countries tried to pitch in to help the relieve the famine. Al-Qaeda conceived the idea. They were in exile at that point in Sudan, but they began to feel that they were being surrounded. They were being encircled by American troops, and they sought to aid the Somali warlords. They were trying to expel the foreign aid groups. I think at that point, bin Laden began to focus his attention on America. But it was really the deciding factor was when during the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait and his troops were massed on the Saudi border, bin Laden had gone to the interior minister and the defense minister in Saudi Arabia and offered to defend the kingdom using al-Qaeda, which in the early 90s was probably just a few hundred guys at most.
Hmm.
He's going to use al-Qaeda and 100,000 unemployed Saudi youth together with the construction vehicles of his father's construction empire to defend the kingdom against this million-man Iraqi army with one of the largest tank corps in the world. And, of course, he was laughed out of the office. But the concept that the kingdom would be invaded by, not by Hussein, but by Americans and other Westerners who were Christians and Jews, and also women, to protect the holy land of Saudi Arabia. This is what really set him off, and his vow was to cleanse the holy land of these kinds of heretics.
It was, again, a humiliation.
Yes, indeed. Exactly so.
More humiliating than the potential that Saudi Arabia, which had lots of weapons but no real army, more humiliating than the idea that they could have been invaded by and occupied by Iraq?
Listen, he hated Saddam Hussein, Osama did. He really was opposed to him all along, but on his deathbed, the Prophet Muhammad is reputed to have said, "Let there be no two religions in Arabia." And many devout Muslims take this to mean that no one except a Muslim can be on the Arabian Peninsula. Hmm. And Osama bin Laden devoutly believed this himself, even though at the time the Prophet made that statement, there were many Jews and Christians in the kingdom. So it's a problematic statement. But for bin Laden, this was a line that that had been crossed, and he was dead set on rectifying it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Boris on the phone in Fort Worth. Hi, Boris.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I read your book some years ago, and I tell you, it was so illuminating and terrifying. At the end of it, I just left thinking it's an implacable foe with whom there could never be any kind of peaceful coexistence. Is that really the basis of Al-Qaeda? There can be no peaceful coexistence?
Well, Al-Qaeda is not really a political organization, so it's very difficult to negotiate with it. Bin Laden had one stated political goal, which was to expel the Christian invaders from the Holy Land. Well, actually, that was accomplished after the Second Gulf War, when the U.S. announced that it was withdrawing its troops from Saudi Arabia. And the very next month, Al-Qaeda began its assault on Western housing compounds in the kingdom. So that told me, among other things, that they were very difficult to placate. It's not an organization, for instance, that aspires to, have a policy for education or health and welfare or the environment or any of those kinds of political goals. It says that it wants to take over a Muslim country and establish a theocracy and establish Sharia. But, the realistic political goals, they don't exist for Al-Qaeda, and it's very difficult to find a way to have any kind of conversation with them. It's different in that sense from the Taliban, which has nationalistic goals.
How close did we come to apprehending or even killing bin Laden after the bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania?
It was a piece of bad luck for us that he wasn't in one of the camps that we destroyed with cruise missiles. He was actually on his way there, and then in the middle of his trip, he suddenly decided to divert and go back to Kabul. So had he followed his original destination, he might have been in that camp, and we might have gotten him. But the truth is, our information wasn't that strong anyway.
So that was 1998. By 2000, you have the U.S. coal bombing. And at that point, Al-Qaeda's plan was very clear. Bin Laden wanted to pull the U.S. into a protracted war in Afghanistan.
Yes. Yeah, it was his goal. It was his great strategy that he thought that what would happen is, if you remember what happened to the Soviet Union when they went into Afghanistan in 1979 and spent 10 years bleeding into the Afghan soil, and then after it pulls out, what happens? The Soviet Union fell apart. It dissolved. And bin Laden became convinced that the same thing would happen to the United States. It would become disunited states. They would fall apart, and that would leave the way open for Islam to regain its rightful place as the leader among powers.
So I want to talk about the U.S. side of things here for a while. There were some very smart people in the FBI, in the CIA, but neither agency seems to have trusted the other with sensitive information that could have saved lives. Can you give us some examples of that?
The worst example that I'm still haunted by is the fact that two members of al-Qaeda arrived in America in January of 2000, Khaled al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. They had just come from a meeting in Kuala Lumpur. As it turns out, they were meeting the people that were going to be doing the USS Cole bombing. And they flew directly to Los Angeles and then went down to San Diego. The CIA learned in March of 2000 that these two men, these two al-Qaeda members, were in San Diego. Now, legally, the agency is obligated to inform the FBI of this. And in fact, just to compound the crime in my mind, the CIA had gotten the information about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur through an FBI wiretap. So it was FBI information that led to this discovery, but the FBI wasn't given that information. So the FBI has a warrant on bin Laden and all members of al-Qaeda. They were legally empowered. They didn't have to do anything illegal. They could track these men. They could wiretap them. They could clone their computers. They could do all of those things. They had the authority to do that, but they weren't apprised of the fact that al-Qaeda was in America. Now, why was that? It's a question that still hangs over this.
We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute with Lawrence Wright. His book is called The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 2007 and has been re-released in trade paperback for the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author, screenwriter, playwright, and New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright. His book is called The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Larry, was that interagency distrust, was it sort of a top-down official thing, that siloing, or was it a more of a field-level occurrence?
It was both, Chris. There were institutional rivalries that have been a part of the sort of worldview of both of those institutions since the very beginning. They've long resented each other's authority. And there are, there are reasons for that. The CIA is after intelligence, and the FBI is after evidence. Once intelligence becomes evidence, it's no longer secret. So in a way, the CIA is always resisting letting things be known. The CIA looks towards the future. It wants to know what's going to happen. The FBI looks towards the past. It wants to be able to see what happened and make arrests if the law has been violated. So you can see that they're kind of Janus-faced and they're linked together in opposition. But at the same time, there were these titanic personal rivalries, mm-hmm. which really split the agencies. I write about John O'Neill, who was the head of counterterrorism in New York, and he was a brilliant and divisive, inspiring figure. But his counterpart in the CIA, Michael Scheuer, who was the head of Alex Station, the virtual bin Laden station in the CIA, he told Congress a few years ago, this grudge is still, even long after John O'Neill has died in 9/11, Scheuer told Congress that there one good thing that happened on 9/11 is that John O'Neill got killed.
And O'Neill's story is so ironic that you couldn't put it into one of your screenplays without people saying, oh, come on. He left the FBI, and not 3 weeks later, and the very next day, I guess, took this job as head of security at the Twin Towers.
That's right. The way I found out about the O'Neill story, after 9/11, you remember that the planes were all grounded, and I was in Austin, desperate to get up to New York and trying to find a way to write about this tragedy and get my hands around some story that I could tell. So I was monitoring the obituaries that were streaming online at the time. And on the Washington Post site, I ran across John O'Neill's obituary, and it made him sound like something of a disgrace because he'd been forced out of the bureau when he'd taken some classified information out of the office. So it sounded like he was, kind of a careless reprobate who had, just made a terrible mistake. But at the same time, I thought he was the head of, the New York counterterrorism office. And so he would be the one in charge of getting bin Laden. But instead of getting bin Laden got him. So whether he was a hero or a villain, I knew he would be a story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Josh in Addison. Hello, Josh.
Howdy. Two real quick questions. The conversation is fascinating. I have not read the book, but it's now on my reading list. Based on the shocking things that you just said, what's past is past, so apparently there was interagency squabbling that led to nobody picking up on what happened on 9/11 at the time. But would you be able to say that the way things stand now, how likely is it that somebody could take advantage of that particular situation again, or do those agencies now get along, like, really much better, and it would be much less likely for that sort of thing to happen again? And the second quick question is, fact or fiction, I'm not paranoid, but I've always wondered if this was true or not. Would you be able to say from your research if, and I don't want to sound silly here, but if actually on 9/11, if the employees who were, I believe, Middle Eastern, who worked in the World Trade Center offices, if virtually none of them showed up to work on that day, if that's actually true or not?
Thanks for your call.
Let me address the second part of that. There was an allegation that the Jews were alerted and that none of them actually went to work on 9/11, and that's not true. Many, many Jews were killed on 9/11, and that rumor started on Hezbollah TV, which is, you can make of that what you will, but it's one of those things that has persisted, for such a long time, and it's just a noxious, discreditable rumor. And as a matter of fact, many other Middle Easterners, Palestinians, also lost their lives on 9/11, who were in the World Trade Center. Many Muslims died, not nearly as many as Jews did, but there were Muslims. On the first part, unfortunately, it's still the case that miscommunication can lead to disaster in our intelligence community. And you saw that if you remember the underwear bomber. This was a young Nigerian man whose father is one of the wealthiest people in Nigeria, as it happens, a banker, who had gotten very concerned about his sons drift into Islamism. And so he went to the American embassy and spoke to the CIA and said to them that he's afraid that his son is going to become a terrorist. He's an Islamist. He's spending a lot of time in Yemen, and he has a visa to America. Now, that's not, those are not dots that need to be connected. They're already connected. And this information goes into the intelligence reporting apparatus. Now, since 9/11, we've made a lot of changes in the American intelligence community, completely reorganized it, and created a whole new tier of bureaucracy and an agency called the National Counterterrorism Center, where members of different, there are 16 different intelligence agencies get together and share information just to make sure we don't make that kind of mistake again. Well, 3 weeks after the Nigerian father comes in and talks to the CIA about his son is on a flight to Detroit with a bomb in his underwear, and it was passengers on the airplane that actually prevented that bomb from going off. It was not our intelligence agencies. So we still have the problem of falling through the cracks.
You think about 16 different law enforcement agencies coming together on a regular basis to share information, and it seems like the greatest challenge would be deciding, even if you're there in all sincerity, deciding what merits discussing and how to match up the fact from this agency with another observation from another agency and recognize that they're talking about the same thing.
It's an overwhelming problem, obviously, and you know, one of the things that's complicating it is that now agencies are fearful of not reporting things they think might be inconsequential because they don't want to be held responsible. So they report everything. And it's a deluge of information that makes it very difficult for analysts to sort through what is a priority, what is real. And, you know, there are 56 FBI offices around the country, and each one of them now has a counterterrorism division. And whether or not there's any real terrorism going on in their communities, they feel obligated to report things. It's you know, it's like a fire hose of information that makes it really difficult for the analyst at the top of the chain.
Well, you know, Larry, it sounds exactly like the issue in the medical profession of doctors being so concerned that they will be sued for malpractice or negligence that they order up, you know, 20 tests when somebody might have done quite well with one.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. I've been to the National Counterterrorism Center, and it's fascinating. You know, it was designed by the Disney Imagineering, and so it looks an awful lot like something you would see at Disneyland. And ironically, a woman I know there had worked at Disney Studios. She had been a movie executive, and she had read an article I'd written about John O'Neill, and decided to stop her movie career and join the FBI, and now she works at the National Counterterrorism Center. And she says that even in the cafeteria, the chairs are the same. The only thing that's different is they don't have the mouse ears.
Can you talk a little bit about what you did to try and secure your own personal safety when you were doing these more than 500 interviews, some of which were with people that were not very nice?
Well, I don't like to think a lot about that because, you know, you can get paralyzed if you start thinking too much about, you know, danger. I mean, when I was in Saudi Arabia, I was there just before the Iraq War, and things were, you know, there was a lot of tumult, and I took some ordinary precautions. I mean, instead of staying in a housing compound, which is where I was told I should stay, and those became the first target, I stayed in a middle-class Saudi flat. I had a job because the Saudis wouldn't let me in as a reporter, so I took a job in Jeddah at this newspaper in bin Laden's hometown, mentoring these young Saudi reporters. And it turned out to be a terrific. You know, they were so much more informative than and helpful than I could have been on my own. Hmm. But I had a car. I had to go to work every day. But I would sometimes I would change the car, and I keep irregular hours. The only time I felt really at sea was in Pakistan, and you know, I was interviewing the first day that I got there. One of the people that had been implicated in the killing of Daniel Pearl, Pearl's widow, Marianne, held this guy responsible for telling everybody that Danny was a Jew. But, of course, Danny never made any secret of it. But, you know, this guy was a very, very good source. And one of the problems with talking to good sources is that, you know, they're close to dangerous elements, and he was. But he turned out to be extremely useful to me. Later, he was killed himself, apparently by one of the Taliban.
So it has to be exciting and gratifying along the way when you start to uncover really interesting things and connections between different individuals and different events. On the other hand, this is one of those stories that I have to imagine beats you down when you focus on it so intently, not only for the 5 years you were writing the book, but honestly, you haven't stopped talking about this based on people's demand for your information in the 5 years after that.
It does affect you. You know, I mean, I never wanted to be a terrorism expert, you know, and I guess that there is also a kind of an element of curiosity and bemusement, even. I mean, there are people on Al Qaeda that are on my Facebook page, so you know, I can't help but look at that and think, you know, the world is really a very, very strange place.
Are we safer today? And is there reason to worry that this massive 10-year anniversary that's coming up in a couple of weeks puts us at greater risk than we have been for a while?
We are safer in some respects. And, you know, I think that Al-Qaeda has been disabled, and it's difficult for it to pull off major operations such as the one that we'll be commemorating on 9/11. On the other hand, you know, they've decided, you know, to try to empower anybody to do anything. Previously, Zawahiri, several years ago, had told his followers to, you know, go out and kill Americans wherever you see them. And, you know, but if you're going to strike inside America, you have to clear it with us, because I think he was thinking that America is Broadway for Al-Qaeda. I mean, they didn't want to follow up 9/11 with some little shopping mall attack. And now I think they're ready for anything like that. And so we might see smaller scale attacks by Al-Qaeda followers or wannabes. What I worry about in a longer term is that Al-Qaeda has created a template for future groups. It may have nothing to do with Islam or even any religion, but they've created a playbook that other groups will begin to follow, and they'll be more empowered with technology and the tools that of social media. So we're likely to see terrorism be a fact of our life for a long time.
Lawrence Wright's Pulitzer Prize-winning book is called The Looming Tower. Larry, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.